Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. As mandated by papal encyclical, two guests and two segments today. Anatole Levin will review U.S. relations with the outside world under the Trump regime, and Samuel Moyne will talk about checks and balances and the need for a better elite. Regular listeners are no doubt familiar with the voice of Anatole Levin. Anatole, one of the finest analysts of global politics I know, is the director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft based in Washington. In the 1980s and 90s, he covered the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and the wars in Afghanistan, Chechnya, and the Southern Caucasus for the Financial Times and the Times of London. An update. I mentioned Ukrainian President Zelensky is trying to neuter his government's anti-corruption efforts, which prompted the first large demonstrations in Ukraine since the Russian invasion. After we recorded this interview yesterday, Zelensky retreated and proposed a new set of laws for consideration by the parliament. Apologies for the occasionally spotty audio. We couldn't get Zencastr, my usual platform, to work, so we resorted to the decidedly inferior Zoom. Anatole Levin. So it looks like Trump's alleged love affair with Putin has hit a few snags. What do you make of this situation?
Well, I'm not sure it was ever a love affair. I mean, Trump is in love with himself, and Putin, well, I suppose if you ask Putin, he'd say he's in love with Russia. So this was always pretty fake. But Trump obviously wanted an easy diplomatic victory, but he's not going to get that from Putin. The Russians have been absolutely clear any ceasefire depends on, as they say, addressing the root causes of the war, which means a whole set of compromises between the US and Russia, but also, well, then, which the US will impose on Ukraine, or at least discuss with Ukraine. We don't know how far Putin is prepared to compromise with whatever the US puts forward, because the US hasn't really put forward anything concrete on these issues yet. I mean, I think the problem is that Trump went into all this without a plan, you know, without any plan except calling for an early ceasefire and making some vague promises to the Russians, which the Russians, of course, are well aware that a Democrat administration after 2028 could simply tear up again, the same way that Trump tore up so many U.S. agreements when he came to power in 2016.
Is there anybody in the Trump circle with any diplomatic skills at all that's anywhere near up to this task?
Witkoff may be a good diplomat in himself, but good diplomats are made, not born. They require expert advice. They require a team. And in circumstances like this with Russia, ideally, they also require a back channel in which people can have a very frank conversation in private. And the Trump administration doesn't have any of these things. So it doesn't actually have the basis for an agreement with Russia. And it hasn't been willing to recruit the kind of people, and they are very limited in number, but there are about, well, three of them, or four, who could actually draw up such a plan. And that's partly because the Trump administration deeply distrusts the security establishment in general, but it's also because, you know, as we saw in the first Trump administration, and, you know, as we're seeing again now, they're just a mess. You know, they are dependent on a lazy, self-obsessed, ignorant, self-willed, I mean, with some, you know, obvious determination and cunning, but still, I mean, a kind of medieval monarch with a very limited attention span. Well, that is no basis for a very, very complicated and difficult international negotiation.
He and the people around him have nothing but contempt for expertise or experience, so there's nothing to draw on there, really.
Well, that's just it, yes. Perhaps if they shuffled their team around, you know, maybe Tulsi Gabbard could, if they'd send her secretly to Moscow to talk to Lavrov, candidly, you know, absolutely in private, look, this is as far as we can go. How far can you go? Maybe that would work. The best man to send on such a mission would have been Bill Burns, you know, former head of CIA and former ambassador to Moscow. His memoir is called The Back Channel. But of course, Trump would never, never, ever use him because of his deep distrust of the CIA establishment.
I don't know if you saw this clip. I saw it the other day of an interview with Christine Lagarde, where someone was asking her about Putin. And she was describing how absolutely in command of his material he is. He knows everything he's talking about. He doesn't really need notes. He's read everything. He's extremely well prepared. Then the follow-up question was, what about Trump? And she just sighed and shook her head.
Well, exactly.
I mean, that's the situation we're in. Now, what about the state of the war? How do you read the balance of forces?
Well, it's very difficult to say because, on the one hand, obviously Russia has the advantage in a long-term war of attrition in terms of military production and in terms of men. But on the other hand, you know, as we really learned from this war, contemporary military technology very much favors the defensive. And Putin is still operating on the basis of a well-paid volunteer army. He obviously does not trust the will of the Russian people or his own popularity to launch mass conscription, which is what the Russian hardliners have been demanding. And without that, the Russians do not actually outnumber the Ukrainians very heavily. So, look, the Russian generals reportedly have been telling Putin that within about 6 months now, the Ukrainians will collapse. Well, if they do, we're in a different world. If they don't, then hopefully Putin will say, look, hang on a second, how long do you expect me to go on? And will offer more reasonable terms. But, I mean, even at the moment, the most reasonable, from a Russian point of view, terms that Putin could possibly offer are very, very different from the minimum that I'm told a Ukrainian government can accept. So it would still require, even if Putin does change his approach, it would still need the US to play a central role in dragging the two sides together. I'm no longer convinced that the Trump administration is capable of that.
Now, they did talk about sending weapons after all this time refusing to send weapons.
If they're to ward off a complete Ukrainian collapse, that is necessary, but it has to be accompanied by a political strategy. I mean, otherwise, you're simply committing yourself to sending weapons to Ukraine forever in the hope of nothing in particular, really, if you don't know what precisely you're aiming at. And I mean, that is one hell of a gamble.
Northrop Grumman would like that, though, I guess.
Well, of course, sure. But, you know, at some stage, just look at the disproportion in populations and the... Well, you know, I've been traveling in Europe and there is more and more opposition in European populations to continuing this level of support for Ukraine.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Just based on the monetary cost or what else?
Yes, but it's also a sort of general backlash against the feeling that establishments, including the unelected Brussels establishment, are dictating to national populations without any regard for their own national interests. I mean, I don't know whether this will come to a head, but it would be very unwise to rely on Western populations supporting this war indefinitely. Whereas, so far, at this level of sacrifice and expenditure, Russia does seem to be able to continue the war. Well, obviously, because, well, it is an authoritarian system. It doesn't have to worry about elections.
Seymour Hersh had a piece the other day in which he said Zelensky's on the way out, drawing on his usual intelligence sources, anonymous intelligence sources. And one of the sources said perhaps feet first, which sounded like a rather dramatic end to his career. Whether that's true or not, we're looking at government reshuffles, quashing the anti-corruption agencies, the first protests in 3 years. These are not promising signs for Zelensky's longevity. So what do you read is going on with him?
Well, I think he is, you know, in very serious trouble because, you know, there is tremendous resentment in the Ukrainian provinces and among the soldiers at the levels of corruption in Kiev and, you know, the gilded youth of educated elite young men who seem to have found a remarkable number of jobs doing essential liaison work with Western donors, which requires them to stay in Kiev or travel to the West, but not, you know, to enlist in the army.
Well, they're pulling people off the street.
Well, yes, but not, you know, not the children of the elite.
No.
So, yes, I think Zelensky is in trouble. But, of course, the question is whether any Ukrainian government could actually bring itself to make the minimal concessions that will be necessary for peace with Russia unless Washington really leans on them. My view is, and Ukrainians have said this, that the only way that Zelensky or any other Ukrainian president can offer a treaty of neutrality, can offer a ban on NATO membership, and you know, a constitutional guarantee of rights for Russian speakers in Ukraine, is if they're able to say to the Ukrainian people, and above all, of course, to the Ukrainian army and the armed national militias, I had no choice. Washington forced me to, and without U.S. support, we can't continue. That is, I think, the only way a Ukrainian government can get away with this. But that requires Washington to have a plan and also, of course, great moral courage on the part of a U.S. administration, because obviously, I mean, a Ukrainian president in these circumstances is going to have to curse the U.S. administration, and so will a large part of Congress and the U.S. media. Trump, given his extraordinary capacity to ride out scandals that would have sunk any other U.S. president, might be able to get away with that. But he has to have a plan to do so. He's got to have a detailed plan for peace, and he doesn't have it.
Well, of course, now the Epstein thing is taking up all the attention of everybody in Washington and outside.
Well, yes. I mean, but that's it. I mean, how many scandals can you handle, or, you know, or crises all at the same time?
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute. Okay, now, looking at another part of the world, the Israel-Palestine conflict, it seems to have entered a new phase of ethnic cleansing, with more open talk of population transfer, or whatever euphemism you want to use. Where are we going here? What do you think?
It's quite obvious that is what the Israelis are aiming at. The Netanyahu government, most of the Israeli security establishment. And you are just finally beginning now to see a stirring of conscience or political pressure in Europe against this. You know, finally the British government is talking about recognizing a Palestinian state and is denouncing what Israel is doing. But of course, unless they actually bring themselves to impose economic sanctions on Israel, this isn't going to have any effect. And I think we're still a long way from that. The other problem is, of course, that because they hate Muslims so much, the extreme right in Europe, which is rising and rising in the polls, is very closely aligned with Israel. So that, you know, even if you see radical political change in Europe, it won't lead to the Europeans turning against Israel. And, of course, as far as the European establishments are concerned, I mean, as we've seen from these grotesque demonstrations of subservience and submission and groveling, they are still so desperate to keep the U.S. militarily engaged in Europe that as long as the U.S. sticks with Israel, I think that the Europeans will do the same.
It's been striking to watch the British government arresting members of Palestine Action and charging them with terrorism. What's driving the fervor of this support? Is it mere subservience to the U.S., or is there something else behind it?
It's a combination of things. It's subservience to the U.S. It is the power of the Israel lobby, which is not as strong as in America, but which is present. It is, of course, a growing fear of Islam and Muslim immigrants in Europe, which is strengthening forces of order if you like, that, you know, that any moves in this direction have to be crushed. But it is, I mean, take Starmer in Britain. I mean, you know, Starmer first made a name for himself as a human rights lawyer. You know, this is also leeching out any degree of idealism or respect for principles, you know, especially from younger people, younger educated people in Europe. It's becoming a kind of hollowed out political civilization.
Now, they're deploying Witkoff, the only man with the skills, I guess, in the Trump administration. Do you think there's any promise for a mission that he will lead to try to bring some peace to the region?
No, frankly. I mean, unless, I mean, if the Arab regimes were to really combine and threaten the expulsion of US bases and maybe, you know, in concert with Russia, a new oil shock, maybe. But they won't do that. I mean, they are far too afraid of their own peoples and far too dependent on the US and far too scared of Israel. I can't see anything else that would shift the Trump administration. And the terms that Trump has offered to Iran are totally unacceptable to the Iranians. No, I mean, I think to see anything change, we will have to see a revolution within the Democratic Party and perhaps within the Republican Party as well. But that's going to take a long time. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I really, really hope I'm wrong, obviously. But I see no grounds for optimism at present.
Yeah, I think the revolution of the Democratic Party is really a long way off, given the way they're reacting to Zohra Mamdani winning the mayoral primary in New York City.
It's quite clear that the Democratic establishment would prefer the Republicans to win than that Mamdani should do so. Of course, I mean, it's only the first, you know, the US and British, you know, electoral systems which are holding these parties together anymore. I mean, there ought to be at least three Democratic parties by now and three Republican parties. I think that will come, actually, but not yet.
Okay, and then the larger picture of what's going on. The U.S. posture towards the world is just more and more withdrawn, more and more supercilious and hostile. Withdrawing from UNESCO is the latest move. We got walls going up on the southern border, literally, but figuratively around the country. There are tariffs, of course. It looks like retreat, though, of course, Trump claims we're now the hottest country in the world. Is there any grand design beyond all this, or is just the would-be monarch barking orders?
Well, I mean, I think the grand design, in a certain sense, is a mafia one. It's the U.S. becoming a sort of grand protection racket. You know, we will go on protecting Japan and South Korea and even perhaps Vietnam and others against China. We will keep our bases in Europe and we will stay in NATO. You know, in return for you other countries accepting massively increased U.S. tariffs. Now, I mean, the thing is that as far as the countries, you know, which actually are part of U.S. alliance systems, and are afraid of Russia and China, actually, this seems to be working pretty well. The countries are knuckling under. But, of course, as far as the rest of the world is concerned, you know, countries which are not part of the Chinese alliance system, but like Brazil, do most of their trading with China, or Indonesia, or which, like India, may be hostile to China, but are also absolutely determined not to kowtow to the United States, which see themselves as independent great powers. This is not going to work. Of course, underlying this is also, you know, as we've seen with sanctions against Russia, the fact that the countries which are part of the U.S. alliance systems, which a couple of generations ago accounted for 75% of the world economy, now account for less than 50%. So this kind of pressure just does not work as widely as it used to.
Yeah, it's interesting. Trump seems very concerned about the role of the dollar in the world, but he's not doing much to boost it except with his crypto scheming. But, you know, the crypto, I guess, is supposed to be backed by treasury papers, so that will somehow boost the demand for treasuries. But, well, he needs to borrow trillions of dollars in the next few years. He may have a real rough time of it.
It's not so much a question of whether he'll have a rough time of it. America will have a rough time of it.
Yes.
And I mean, I do think over time, I mean, all of this has to undermine U.S. global economic hegemony and strengthen the attractiveness of China, which, you know, except sometimes when it comes to fairly enough collecting its debts, does not bully countries in this way. And, you know, does not, at least as yet, appear to have any desire for this kind of global hegemony. So, I mean, at the moment, for the moment, some of this seems to be working well enough in a crude way for Trump. But a generation from now, who can say?
Okay, then to conclude with China, are they just sitting back and watching the U.S. self-destruct? What's their strategy?
Well, I hope they are. Certainly the Chinese officials with whom I've spoken have been very anxious to stress or to argue or to claim that there is no plan to seize Taiwan while Xi Jinping is still president, that China can wait as long as the U.S. doesn't do something radical like, you know, recognizing Taiwanese independence or putting American troops in Taiwan. China is in no hurry. And I hope that's the case. It is really important to point out that despite all this, you know, grotesque talk, you know, among Western hardliners and the media and the think tanks about this supposed, you know, alliance of authoritarianisms, you know, China has shown no desire or plan, none, to undermine the US in the Middle East. And the Chinese say again and again in private, look, you know, our only interest there is that the energy should continue to flow. You know, we have no agendas there. We don't want to get involved. As a Chinese diplomat said to me years ago, why on earth would we get involved in that mess? Look at all the trouble it's caused the United States. So I think the Chinese are actually being pretty cautious. And, you know, in Ukraine, for example, the Chinese do not want to see Russia defeated. I mean, they do regard Russia as a very important partner, especially from an energy point of view. But equally, the Chinese are not allies of the Russians. They're not sending arms or let alone troops to help the Russians. And they say, you know, they have no interest in a complete Russian victory. I think, touch wood, Chinese are playing a cautious hand. The problem is, though, that by their very foolish policy in the South China Sea, you know, of making these grotesquely huge territorial claims, in their immediate neighborhood, they've frightened a lot of people, which has done them a great deal of damage. But they haven't done that in Africa or the Middle East or Latin America.
They seem pretty gentle in their imperial strategies. You know, the Belt and Road Initiative has helped out a lot of countries. It doesn't look like a classic Western development scheme, which is far more exploitative. Am I being too sunny in my interpretation of that?
No, I mean, I think I was just in Georgia, and the Chinese are building a huge amount of infrastructure there. All too much of the Western aid has gone to trying to persuade Georgian farmers that they should give up or block their very profitable markets in Russia in order to export to the European Union, which really does not want Georgian fruit or wine, and, you know, lecturing them on democracy and freedom. The Chinese have not been, till now, developing military bases, you know, elsewhere in the world. They just haven't, outside the South China Sea. There are these repeated claims that they are. And then, of course, when you investigate, it turns out they're not. But nobody in the media or think tank world ever corrects these claims. So there is this, you know, attempt to build up this Chinese universal monster, which, as far as I can see, does not actually exist. I mean, as yet, 50 or 100 years from now, God knows, but not at present.
Well, 50 or 100 years from now, God knows what's whether we'll still be alive.
Well, I mean, you know, we
personally
you and I, Doug, will be discussing this in another world.
Yes.
I hope over a decent glass of wine or a cloud.
That was Anatole Levin, Eurasia director at the Quincy Institute. I mentioned a clip of an interview with Christine Lagarde, now the president of the European Central Bank, a position she's held for the last 6 years. She was previously the managing director of the IMF, and before that, the French Minister of Finance. The question towards the end of the clip, which wasn't translated, was if Trump is the same. A smooth professional, all Lagarde could do was sigh. Christine Lagarde.
What I'm sure is still the case is that he's unbelievably thorough, detailed, knowledgeable, and when he works on a file with you, he doesn't have any paper, he doesn't have any material, he doesn't have any briefing. He knows it inside out. So to deal with him, certainly in my days, I had to know my file inside out and by heart. And I think that has to do with the training that he's had as an intelligence secret service kind of person, where you really need to have everything in your head and no paper, so in case you get caught. So I would say to deal with him, you really need to know everything, because he knows everything about you.
Bei Donald Trump ist es genau das Gegenteil, oder?
That was Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank. You're listening to Behind the News on Jacobin Radio. My name is Doug Henwood, back after a musical break. That was some of the theme from what is usually called the Ghost Variations by Robert Schumann, the last piece of music he wrote before entering a mental asylum, as they used to say. It was performed by András Schiff. Next, checks and balances in the role of elites. Samuel Moyn, another voice familiar to regular listeners, is part of an exchange in the Boston Review, responses to an essay by Lisa Miller on the deficiencies of checks and balances, that is, those mechanisms of the American constitutional system that were supposed to prevent the power grab by the likes of Trump. They haven't worked. Sam's contribution focuses on deficiencies in our elites and the importance of having an actual agenda. He is a professor of both law and history at Yale, Samuel Moyn. We haven't talked in a bit. Checks and balances are looking kind of good these days. Are you still adhering to your critique?
I don't think they're looking good. I mean, the legislature is supine.
At least in concept, let me put it that way.
Oh, well, I mean, there people are grasping at straws, but that's not very creditable. I mean, the legislature's doing nothing except complying, and the judiciary is largely signing off in the end on Donald Trump's agenda. So the judiciary, contrary to expectations, is not really proving a bulwark of freedom against fascism, meaning the people have to. So it's I don't see any reason to idealize checks and balances in light of our current experiences.
Now, the Supreme Court certainly fits that description. Would you apply that to the lower federal courts too?
No, but it's a hierarchical system. So any liberal decision is going, in the end, going to depend on whether the conservative Supreme Court upholds it. So that's the system. So it's like saying, you know, the success of the minor league team, like, vindicate the atrocity of what's happening to my team in the majors. No.
Now, the critique of checks and balances that you and, you know, the Lisa Miller, the who wrote the essay you responded to in the Boston Review, the critique boils down to that they often inhibit good things from happening, inhibit the government from doing anything positive. They're mostly a negative. And we're talking about the New Deal or watching things in the present now. They inhibit good things from happening. But on the other hand, Trump has managed to just steamroller over all those old verities, all the checks and balances, all their power has been revealed to be rather phantasmic. So what happened? Why is he getting away with something that FDR couldn't?
Okay, so first, Lisa Miller is basically kind of reminding us that checks and balances weren't great. I think mainly for the reason you mentioned, that they inhibit good things, but I think she's also intent on showing how they're minoritarian and they allow minority actors to block things in the system. So they perpetuate bad things along with inhibiting good things. And I guess I would say that FDR managed to build a one-party state for decades. That's way beyond anything that Democrats or Republicans, including Donald Trump, have done lately. If you compare the first 100 days of FDR and Trump, FDR did way more. And it's not just that it was better. It's true that FDR was blocked, but in the end, after a few years, and especially the 1936 election, FDR really created a kind of steamroller, the likes of which Donald Trump has not approached. So that's how I would narrate him. Am I wrong?
FDR also had giant congressional majorities and huge approval.
Exactly. Both times, but especially after 1936, when the Supreme Court, which did pose an obstacle to FDR's first New Deal, basically relented because he had such popular support. And Donald Trump doesn't. To me, that's the pivotal fact.
Of course, people see him sending the army in and, you know, cutting the funding for universities. And, you know,
Like
an authoritarian strongman rule.
I agree. My read on that is that, you know, both parties really, since FDR, have built an all-powerful presidency. And the path of least resistance, even if you, or especially if you just have a little bit more power than your opponents, is to rely on the presidency. And, you know, frankly, the judiciary has been signing off on what it's been doing in both parties for decades. So if we're undergoing authoritarianism, it's very deeply rooted at this point.
Now, the other part of the checks and balances system that people often revere is the federal system. The states are supposed to offer a counterweight to intense federal power. How are they doing in that regard?
I think it depends on the state. A state like California can really put up a fight. The truth is that many of the poorer states are deeply reliant on federal monies. Sometimes they refuse those, like the southern states don't always take the Medicaid they could give out to their own poor citizens, but it varies from state to state. In the end, I think Lisa Miller is right to, you know, say we shouldn't romanticize local progressive ventures, because in the end they're local and they don't affect the federal budget, they don't affect federal foreign policy, and they leave others in the union out to dry. And so she's right to focus in the end on the national picture, which isn't to say that there aren't bright spots when you look below the level of the federal government.
You, in your response, talk about working with elites, which I think some people will find distressing.
Yes.
The usual rallying cry to fight tyrannical power is mobilization of a broad popular movement. Now, you write about the inevitability of elites, so let's talk about that for a moment. I spent some time a few years ago reading Italian elite theory, and I have to admit that my resistance to the inevitability of elites was breached. But why do you think they're inevitable?
Well, it's really based on those writings, which were really translated and made the founding lesson of Anglophone political science. And really the idea is that power in society consists in a circulation of elites. And the real questions are, how do we control them? How do we make them serve the people? We need a broad-based movement, but in the end, there are going to be folks who have more power in government, especially, and in parties that serve government. One of the best examples of elite theory is from a part Italian, Roberto Michels, who did a study of socialist parties, which are supposed to be democratic, but he showed that even they are subject to hierarchy. And so I'm all for having a permeable boundary between elites and everyone else. And a larger number so that there are more people who can become elites, and especially we need to think about how to control elites through mobilization on the streets and in politics. But I thought Lisa Miller left out that in abandoning checks and balances, we can't believe that the people will just rule themselves, because we know that there are going to be elites in any political system.
Well, I'm sure my anarchist friends will listen to this and say, that's part of the problem. We need politics to focus on eliminating elites, not working with them or creating better ones. So what do you say to that critique?
Well, you know, it's hypothetical, because we're all on the same side in opposing the misrule of illicit elites. And the question is, you know, what should take their place? And my own view is someone like FDR paved the way to understanding that control of the state and its power is the game in politics. And of course, then staffing it with your friends who become new elites. Hopefully, there are ways culturally and politically to get the new elites to serve the common good and to answer to the people. And the people in the end have power to throw them out too. But I don't believe we've seen an example that falsifies this elite theory that really did suggest that we should learn to control and get elites to serve us rather than wish for an end to politics, as if no law, no government will lead to better outcomes.
One of the things I found persuasive about this Italian school was the idea that to become a political leader, you need time, you need education, you need exposure to power. These sorts of things are not universally available to everybody. So the mechanisms of society almost inevitably produce these elites that will emerge within institutions. Do you agree?
Yeah, that's the story. And one of the great American followers of these figures, like Gaetano Mosca, I've already mentioned Michels and Vilfredo Pareto, all these Italians, really kind of new Machiavellians, they thought of themselves this way, is a Yalie like you and me, sort of Robert Dahl. And the real name of the game is like, well, what kind of elite theory do we back? I think it's really important to focus on, well, how are elites selected? How are they trained? There are mostly terrible ways in history that that's happened. But I think the left should have its own idea of how to form those who will participate more than others in actually doing the work of politics, as you say.
You talk about creating better elites, but our current elite looks absolutely miserable and rotten. And this is part of my understanding of why American society is in such trouble. We have a really corrupt upper class. The better among them, the liberal side of the elite, they look weak and lack any kind of self-confidence. The worst, people around Trump for shorthand, are repressive and cruel. So where are we going to find a better elite to work with?
I think that's a $64 million question, but I would pose it differently, that we've had a kind of centrist misrule that set up the situation now with the far right backlash, but also making possible a kind of progressive backlash in the form, especially of Bernie Sanders' candidacy. So I think our story is really elites of both parties backing neoliberalism and neoconservatism and foreign policy or something close to it. And we're living through just the ruins of those mistakes. And you're absolutely right that we need to throw a bunch of people out of power. I don't have a trouble with Trump's success in decapitating the Republican Party. The trouble is that the Sanders insurgency and his successors haven't successfully reformed the Democratic Party. And when they do so, you're right. I think we need new people. We probably need new institutions. You went to Yale. I teach there. You know, I'm not going to say we should close it, but we need institutions that do better in inculcating a public-spirited set of elites. And by that, you know, I just mean politicians who actually are trying to serve the common good and the people.
I'm speaking with the law and history professor Samuel Moyne. Well, you know, I had a great time at Yale. It was a wonderful place to go to college, especially for a guy who came out of nowhere in New Jersey to be exposed to that level of wealth and power and influence and sophistication. It was really quite an experience. And to watch the Trump administration attacking the Ivies fills me with very mixed feelings, because on the one hand, I do think these institutions should be liquidated and their money given to poor public universities. On the other hand, they're doing it for all the wrong reasons. So how can we sort out this this war of the Ivies?
Well, I completely agree. I mean, you know, Trump's attack should be repudiated because it's really on the fact that these are some of the most progressive institutions with some mistakes in the mix. But as someone who did not experience this myself as an undergrad, but has spent my career as a teacher in these Ivies, I am a fan of not of destroying these institutions, but of broadening the opportunities they provide and making sure to fund everywhere so that we can level up the kinds of things you experience, the kinds of things I try to provide the Yale students as a head college head, you know, Calhoun in your day, Grace Hopper now, are some of the pinnacle achievements of our civilization, and the education is second to none. And that's why Trump is attacking them. And the question is how to democratize that. It's the same question, really, as the question about elites. These institutions can't be passed to just privilege alone and power to rule everyone else, especially to misrule them. But that doesn't mean we should just destroy them, because what will be left in there in the wake of that act?
We can also parenthetically note that some of our better public institutions are under attack. The state of Indiana has launched a war on its flagship university, which has been one of the great public sector universities. So it's just grotesque.
It's decades of defunding. I mean, my degree is from Berkeley, my doctoral degree in history, and that was a pinnacle institution, still is. And yet, California has been defunding it, as most of the states have been defunding their public universities for decades at this point.
Okay, back to the elite question. How do we make better ones? I mean, think back what you're talking about, the FDR era, the early decades after World War II. There was a Cold War, the threat of the Soviet Union. We had unions. Those were counterbalances to, you know, unrestrained capitalist ruling class greed. Now we don't have those things. Is there some way we can substitute for those, or do we need some kind of rehabilitation or reconstruction of those sorts of institutions?
I think inevitably we need most of all a better Democratic Party, but of course that's only going to happen and operate in tandem with a renovated civil society, which would include all kinds of organizations. We also can't imagine the kind of successful model we're spitballing about without a reboot of our commitment to public education, because where do you get these poisonous elites? It's from not just Yale, but the whole complex of elite private schooling, which basically has created two societies, the rich and the rest, in a neoliberal age. And without a functioning public school system that actually democratizes education, we can't possibly democratize opportunity. And so we're really in a fix. And my view is that even if we go back to normalcy after Trump and business as usual, and avoid the authoritarian specter, we're still in that situation where we've chosen a society based on hierarchy, and absolutely education and civil society are going to be central to overcoming that syndrome.
I guess one of the worst of these characters is Mark Andreessen, who is the product of the University of Illinois, so there are some exceptions.
Oh, sure. I mean, a lot. Well, Peter Thiel pays people not to go to college, so...
Although he himself has multiple degrees from Stanford.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Ted Cruz, all these characters are Ivy educated, and now they're at war with elites, even though they emerge from them. What are your thoughts on mechanisms of better elite production? How can we go about this project?
We're in a different situation from the 1950s, when you had tremendous union density and the kind of organization of capitalism that allowed it. Now we're in much more of a service economy. And my view is that we're not in a situation where we're going to organize from factories the way that was done on, you know, Fordism or whatever you want to call it in the 1950s and 60s. I would think we need a new spirit both in and outside government to spread opportunities so that the kinds of things that knowledge workers get to do, things like are happening in Silicon Valley are more possible for ordinary people to get involved in. And that's like opening a big debate about the future of like how the American economy is going to function and be organized. I don't think we're going back, though definitely Biden and Trump alike promised it, to a kind of manufacturing utopia of the 50s, which, as you said, did allow union strength and therefore the kind of like civil society infrastructure that could challenge elites and maybe even produce new elites. The short answer is I don't know, Doug, because we're in an unprecedented situation, but I'm skeptical that we can just like take the old models and pretend we can go back there. That's been a false promise on the part of both parties in the response to neoliberalism for decades now.
I just was involved in a very distressing thread on Twitter. Our cognitive elite has some problems. There are people who are arguing, this one guy in particular is arguing, that no one needs to read The Wealth of Nations. You could just ask ChatGPT what's in it. And I don't know, there seems to be a very widespread revulsion from inquiry and knowledge and rigor and difficulty.
Yes. Well, that's true. I personally am not a doomsayer, because I see students every day who really want to, in part because they're being offered positions in the elite, to do a lot of the work that it takes to prepare for that role. I mean, now maybe they're being told to read the wrong things, but I agree with you. Our relation to technology is going to radically change all these questions. And if you're right that you really need elites because of the kind of training that is required, well, then if we don't think ahead about how we're going to preserve elite formation for the common good in this technological transformation, then we're screwed.
I saw some AI guy, works at Microsoft, and I think he's probably involved in AI at Microsoft, and he's arguing that telling people that they need to read stuff rather than using AI is just a form of AI shaming, was the phrase he coined, and it is elites trying to retain their gatekeeping roles in the face of the AI threat. So, I don't know, reading The Wealth of Nations become like an elite luxury good that denied by intent.
It already is.
Denied by intent.
Sure. I mean, he's right that, you know, you should never spit in the wind. But I think that there are going to be, I mean, AI is good for getting us out of drudgery, but it's not good for creative acts. And you see that, I think, any time someone tries to present a ChatGPT poem or short story, which is really just modeled on something humans have done before. So the innovation is always going to fall to human beings, and that's true like across the board. And I can't promise that we're going to have the elite curriculum look like it's looked for decades or centuries. It's not. But is there going to be a role for people who are going to put in the effort to become creative and learn how to do that? Absolutely.
And finally, to return to the themes of that Boston Review exchange, you wrote, people rarely support changes in how they organize politics in the absence of promises what a new politics will deliver. It's not enough to focus on the checks and balances and all the mechanisms of governance. You need some substance to your agenda. So what would the core of that agenda be, in your view?
I found it ironic that Lisa Miller, to whom I was responding, kind of complained about people being obsessed with process, but really then focused on why checks and balances aren't enough. Well, that's true, but what is going to be enough is some vision for the future of the country. And I think FDR, just one last time, is someone who very intently focused on a message to the American people about what would make their lives better. Now, I've gestured a little bit in this direction, but I think we need a politician who is going to look at American carnage, which Trump was right about, and say, I have a solution, which is not going to be punishing immigrants and pretending we can go back to the 1950s. I've suggested it probably ought to be about finding ways that very small numbers of people in the knowledge economy currently enjoy to seed innovation in the United States so people have something productive to do with their lives rather than just vegetate. And so who that's going to be, I don't know. And I'm hoping that I get to see that rather than the Democratic Party, which has been so compliant with some of these pathologies.
Well, it's interesting to watch people like Hakeem Jeffries, who is my personal congressman, I'm embarrassed to say, fighting Zoran Mamdani. This guy is, successful, extremely talented politician with a lot of ideas that proved very popular, and he becomes the enemy. It's really a very dark moment.
Well, that's right. I think it's the New York political scene is quite interesting in that regard, because you've got centrists and leftists coexisting in a very small bubble, but with a constituency that's very divided on some very central issues like Israel. And I completely agree with you that Mamdani is someone who represents a different generation and a vision of a future New York that's extremely exciting. And the question is how to find national versions of that same thing and force the old Democrats out of the way in the name of a new Democratic Party.
But people like Jeffries want to strangle it in his crib.
Of course, of course. Well, this is the trouble with elites, that the bad ones reduce their goals to retaining power indefinitely. And that's the story of the Democratic Party, especially its older members.
It's intriguing that some of the elites, the older elites, are using Mamdani's emergence from a different kind of elite as a weapon against him. They're affecting this false populism in the face of this guy as an offspring of a movie director and a college professor, as if those are terrible things.
I agree completely. I don't think these Democrats, especially those who've been in office for decades and decades, are salt of the earth. And they've convicted themselves by their own acts and policies as people who betrayed the people they claim to serve. So they can't pull rank on Mamdani or, frankly, anyone.
That elite business makes me uncomfortable, but we really do have to think this through instead of dismissing it with fantasies of a non-hierarchical society. Perhaps I'm being too gloomy in that. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Brahms wrote some variations on the theme from Schumann that we heard earlier for two pianos. Here's part of the last variation performed by the Geister duo, David Salmon and Manuel Viard. Till next week, bye.